I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire and National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. I'm recording this intro to the latest edition of the program in the graveyard hours. It's almost 3 a.m. here, but I feel that I needed to get this episode out in light of news breaking that violence is already erupting in Afghanistan. The Taliban has cracked down violently, apparently, on protesters in Jalalabad. And I must say, this conversation, which was recorded at 11 a.m. my time here on the East Coast, Wednesday, August 18th, with journalist Patrick Coburn, a real expert on the Middle East who has been covering the wars in the Middle East for decades now. He joined me to discuss what the future may hold for Afghanistan under the Taliban. And just hours later, we have this news from Jalalabad. Speaking honestly here, I felt the conversation got a little bit ominous in a way, as we talked about Patrick's not buying the Taliban's claims that it had become more moderate. So I'm trying to get this episode out as quickly as possible because developments are happening at a breakneck pace. I felt this conversation was a rather interesting and fascinating one, and few people in Western journalism are as knowledgeable about Afghanistan as Patrick Coburn. You can read his work at The Independent. He is a really, really incredible resource. And with that being said, let's get right to the second in our series of reflections on Afghanistan. This time, our guest is again journalist Patrick Coburn. Welcome back to Parallax Views. Patrick Coburn, author of a number of books, most recently War in the Age of Trump, and also a really great Middle East correspondent for The Independent. How are you doing today, Patrick?
I'm doing good, thank you.
So I wanted to have you back on the show because of the recent developments in Afghanistan. The government has fallen. It seems the Taliban is back under control. Were you as taken by surprise by this as many here in the States? I mean, the rapid nature of the collapse of the government and the retakeover by the Taliban.
Yes, I was taken by surprise by the speed it happened. But when I sort of thought about it again, it reminded me very much of what happened in 2001 when the Taliban fell, at the time of the U.S.-backed overthrow of the Taliban after 9/11. I think that what people get wrong is they emphasize on the weakness of the Afghan army, the corruption, you know, the ghost battalions, lack of food, the ammunition. This is all true, but it's been true for some time. But there's warfare in Afghanistan over the last 40 years, maybe much longer. It's rather different from elsewhere. That once the different factions, parties, tribes, ethnicities, cities, in Afghanistan spot a winner, they tend to join the winning side just as soon as they can. And it's rather dangerous not to do so and end up on the losing side. So I think once they felt and had indeed seen that the U.S. was doing a deal with the Taliban, as they saw last year when Donald Trump signed an agreement with them, and that was reinforced when Joe Biden spoke on the 14th of April and said the U.S. would be out by the 11th of September. Once they decided, right, the U.S. has done a deal with the Taliban, people thought we should do the same. By people, I mean, you know, warlords, military commanders, you know, provincial governors, people of power. And that's why you suddenly have this sort of what appears to be a sort of complete collapse. It's not quite a collapse. It's the wrong word. It's an awful lot of powerful business people and also just ordinary individuals trying to survive. And once they decided that the U.S. had done that deal, they did the same themselves, and the government, you know, was gone within a week.
With regards to, you know, the U.S. misunderstanding or not seeing this coming, do you think there may have been, I don't know if intel failures is the right word, but it seems like you had, as you point out in your latest article, your latest column at The Independent, you had people like Biden saying there is no clear path for the Taliban to victory. I believe Boris Johnson made similar comments. As you point out, they were probably being told this by intelligence chiefs, no?
Yeah, I think so. People like that don't really speak without some briefing. Now, of course, all the intelligence agencies and lots of other folk are saying, oh, we saw it coming. I just don't believe that. I think they probably put forward sort of six options of things might come, and this might have been a worst case. You know, and there were reasons for thinking it wouldn't happen. You know, first of all, government forces are meant to be 300,000 troops. In fact, they're probably much less because of the ghost battalions I mentioned. You know, but 75,000 Taliban. But they certainly outnumbered them. They were better equipped than the Taliban. So it could be reasonable to think, you know, it'll take some time. Even if the government's going to go down, it'll take some time for it to happen. But that didn't take into account the process I mentioned of people very swiftly changing sides. That happened in the 90s also when the Taliban first emerged. There were swift advances, but often very little resistance. And the reason was that people would decide the Taliban were the winner and would join them. Or alternatively, and there's a cruder thing that happens in Iraq, is the Taliban in the past have always paid a lot of money. You know, there's a military commander, battalion commander, divisional commander who might fight. You know, they pay him to go away. When the Taliban went down in 2001, you know, the U.S. and the Northern Alliance, the anti-Taliban coalition they were backing, used to do the same thing. You know, they were just, there was a lot of money going out. So I think the same thing happened. And you see, in Afghanistan, as I said, it's a very fragmented society. The Taliban come out of the Pashtun community in the south, and they make up about 40%, a bit more, of the population. But the other 60% or so is made up of minorities of the Uzbeks, of the Tajiks, of the Hazaras, and others. Now, they didn't resist in the north, where they dominate in the north of Afghanistan. Why? I think because they did deals, their local leaders did deals with the Taliban, because they didn't much like the government anyway, and they thought, you know, the Taliban will win, the government will lose, let's go with the tide.
The question that a lot of people have now is, at least here in the U.S., is what comes next for Afghanistan? And, you know, I know a lot of people are looking at what the Taliban is saying. I knew a lot of people even here in the U.S. that were watching the Taliban press conference. I believe the BBC aired it. And I think the Taliban is sort of trying to present itself as having moderated in some ways. They're talking a good game about women being able to go to university and whatnot. Do you think this is all PR, or has the Taliban moderated in some ways, or are they going to have to deal with maybe resistance to becoming more repressive if they choose to become more repressive?
I think you're right. I think it is mostly PR. I think they're going to be sort of Mr. Nice Guy for the next few weeks or maybe months when there's world attention is focused on Afghanistan, when there are journalists still there, diplomats are still there. They want to impress the outside world that, that the new moderate Taliban, frankly, I don't believe it. I think they haven't changed much. They were very sort of regressive force in 2001 when they last fled. You had ministers who would have somebody to sign their name for them because they couldn't read and write, I don't know how much has that changed. They got some people who speak good English now. They've been advised, to be nice. Remember the Pakistan's intelligence, military intelligence, the ISI, is also behind them, will be advising them to be moderate, to not to give the impression that they're the bad old Taliban. But frankly, I don't believe it. I think that I don't think most Afghans believe it. They think that the Taliban are waiting their time. But that time hasn't quite come when they'll, we'll find that moment, for instance, the schools are shut in Kabul, and they're putting a message saying, wait, we will decide later what is to be done. Probably they haven't quite decided yet, but outside Herat University, there were Taliban fighters turning back women students. So I'm very dubious. It's not just women or interpreters people focus on. 4 million Afghans are Shia Muslims, normally persecuted by the Sunni. I understand the Taliban have blown up a statue of a Shia hero in Kabul, so all these people are under threat. These people are already being attacked. You may recall earlier this year, there was a bomb went off outside a girls' school, Hazara, that's a Shia girls' school in Kabul, and killed 85 people, mostly schoolgirls. So I think it's pretty ominous.
Is there hope for, I don't know, resistance against the Taliban as a regressive force? I mean, have things changed since they were last in power, where there may be a populace that won't put up with a more regressive regime?
Well, how do you sort of not put up with it? you go out into the street and protest, maybe you just get shot, there isn't an armed force which is posing them. There are people talking about resistance, particularly in sort of old areas. There are some areas that the Taliban never conquered last time round. There's an area, actually, which I was in for a long period just before the fall of Kabul in 2001, called the Panjshir Valley. And I don't think the Taliban invented that. But people there are talking about resistance. But then that's going to be pretty tough because you're facing, the Taliban have just won, they'll be reinforced, they'll inherited all the equipment of the Afghan army. How are you going to do that? You'd need foreign support. Where would you get that foreign support from? The Taliban had continual support from Pakistan. There's a 1,600-mile frontier between Afghanistan and Pakistan, so they got support from there. When the Taliban were overthrown by the Northern Alliance in 2001, they got support from the US. So who are you going to be supported by, or are you? If you aren't, you're going to be short of what you need to resist them. So I'm sure there will be resistance. I suspect that resistance will grow. You see, I think the picture people should have of Afghanistan, I haven't been there, is that it's a very diverse country with lots of sort of different forces. And the Taliban probably could stabilize it under their rule if they ran it as a sort of federal state, you know, that the northerners kind of did their own thing, and the Pashtun in the south, similarly, the tribes there in the center, again, different. You know, Kabul is much more secular. Are they sophisticated enough to do that? I really sort of doubt it. You know, the benefits they bring are security, but basically they sort of, you know, control the streets, but not much else. So I think that, you know, if they try to assert their force over and unite sort of Afghanistan, they can only do that by pretty relentless violence against people, which is really what they did in the past. And that, of course, will create resistance to their rule.
In regards to the U.S.'s withdrawal, could this have ended any other way? Just in your opinion, I mean, people are calling it a Saigon moment, but I don't know. Would this have ended any differently if we had pulled out, say, in May, as Trump had wanted to do so?
I don't think of these as sort of, you know, as I said, you know, either one side was going to win or the other. And once Afghans had decided the Taliban were the winners, they switched sides, and suddenly people in the army weren't prepared to die for the government. You know, it was kind of a weak government. Whenever I'd been in Kabul or Afghanistan, what always struck me was, you know, people didn't like the Taliban, particularly not in Kabul, but they really hated the government because of its extreme corruption, you know, its incompetence, its sort of, you know, a lot of these people, Ashraf Ghani, you know, and after I was an American citizen, I mean, the president has just fled. A lot of these people were not very deeply rooted in the society. They were also regarded as sort of thieves by the racketeers, by local people. So who's going to get killed for them, you know? So, you know, they were pretty discredited. Could it have ended differently? Probably at this stage, it was always heading in that direction. I think it did. One, the U.S. sort of did a side deal with the Taliban. It ignored the Baghdad government. The Kabul government. It conducted these negotiations in Gatter. It, you know, then sort of forced concessions by the Kabul government, releasing 5,000 Taliban prisoners and so forth, and didn't extract any concessions from the Taliban. So that again was taken as a sign that the U.S. had, you know, was pretty well switching sides, or certainly was no longer supporting the Kabul government as it had. And then that was sort of reinforced, I think, on the 14th of April when Biden was kind of grandstanded about the withdrawal. I guess for domestic American opinion, he wanted to be seen as the sort of the man who got the U.S. finally out of Afghanistan. And in a way, ironically, you know, what's happened has proved that Biden was right. He always, you know, more than most people in Washington had said it was a bad idea to be there, that the Afghan government was rotten, you know. But he didn't draw the conclusion that he was dead right. It was so rotten that if the U.S. left and sort of put this up in lights, this might lead to a sort of landslide, which would bring the Taliban to power. If they'd done it more quietly, you know, step by step, then it probably wouldn't have happened in this way. Most of the people who are criticizing Biden now are saying if we'd stayed on a bit longer and so forth. Well, as Biden himself said, you know, 20 years didn't do it. 25 years isn't going to do it. So, you know, from the U.S. point of view, I thought most of what he said was true, that, you know, the U.S. intervention wasn't going anywhere. It hadn't gone anywhere when Obama had 100,000 troops there in whenever it was, 2011. And, you know, it wasn't going to prop them up when the U.S. had 2,500 troops there. So, you know, this was the trend. I'd hesitate to say inevitable, It could have been handled in a different way, less melodramatic way, but the basic factors of the situation wouldn't have changed.
It sounds like Biden may have been right, at least from your and probably I would say my perspective about the withdrawal, but the way it was executed, the exit strategy may have been something worth criticizing.
That's correct, yeah. I think the sort of dramatization, I think to impress domestic opinion in the U.S., had sort of set off this sort of political landslide in Afghanistan. You know, also got Taliban stronger. The Taliban are a pretty frightening lot. You don't want to get on the bad side of them. If you decide those guys are going to be winners, you want to change side early. You don't want to wait around, you know, too long. Because they, you know, there may not be a deal. You may not be offered a deal at that stage. So if you're going to switch early.
In regards to how this all relates to the U.S., we currently have certain Republican figures like Crenshaw coming out and, you know, saying we were in Afghanistan because it prevented terrorism. You know, we shouldn't nation build, but we have to stay there. We should have stayed there because it prevents terrorism. Do you really think, though, that is a Taliban-led Afghan government a national security threat to the U.S. is what I'm asking.
I don't think less than people have portrayed it for a couple of pretty concrete reasons. You know, the Taliban has never been like ISIS, Islamic State, or Al-Qaeda in having sort of international, well, you know, world-changing ambitions. Its ambitions have always been within Afghanistan. Secondly, and I think there's a very important thing here that people miss, before 2001, when Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda had camps in Afghanistan, you know, it was a two-way traffic, if you like. I mean, they needed the Afghans, but the Taliban needed them. Osama provided money, maybe sort of connections that could bring them more money, mainly from Saudi Arabia. They supplied sort of, you know, quite a number of fanatical fighters to fight on the Taliban side. Remember, just before 9/11, the Al-Qaeda assassinated the sort of main resistance Northern Alliance leader,
Massoud,
Ahmad
Shah
right? Massoud. Yeah, this was a few days before 9/11, you know. So that showed, you know, what Al-Qaeda was doing for the Taliban. They'd got rid of their most powerful enemy. So, you know, those were things that Al-Qaeda and the like brought to the Taliban at that time. It's not true anymore. The Taliban don't need these guys anymore. They won, you know. So, and having these guys, hosting these guys, brings nothing but problems to the Taliban. So I think there's much less likelihood of that happening. You know, this is going to stir things up in, particularly across the border in Pakistan, although they've been backed by the Pakistan. You know, how far will Pakistan have an influence over them? Could it be end up like sort of, you know, the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia and after 1975 were have been backed and indeed created by Vietnam, but it sort of turned on them. You know, could this happen again? But I don't think what people are envisaging that we'll be back to 2001 and Al-Qaeda will be back in business in Afghanistan. The situation's moved on from there for the reasons I mentioned.
What does the Taliban's takeover and, you know, the fleeing of this figure Ghani, the sort of collapse of the government, what does that portend not only for Afghanistan but just broadly, what does it pretend for geopolitics going forward? You know, is there anything we can say about Russia, China, Iran? I mean, we mentioned Pakistan. What does this mean for all the countries that are accepting that this has occurred and whatnot?
Well, it's kind of a blow to the U.S., you know, because they failed to get what they wanted, you know. But it's not a mortal blow, you know. This is sort of, you know, this was a a war, you know, which in some ways it's a plus for the U.S. that they're no longer engaged in the war in, you know, Afghanistan. And, you know, they've just suffered a setback there. You could say that the U.S., you know, is not the superpower it quite it was in 2001. But I think that I think it probably has changed, you know, is U.S. opinion, you know, that U.S. opinion is much more focused on domestic affairs in the U.S., so it could appear to me. There's much, you know, there's much less attention on what happens abroad. That people, you know, if you look at looking at U.S. newspapers and television and so forth, you know, it's all focused on Trump or anti-Trump or Democrats and Republicans and you know, the attitudes to COVID and what COVID is doing. So I think that there's a sort of shift in U.S. attitude. You know, one will see in the long term, not in the short term, but what the reaction to pulling out of Afghanistan is. Will it do Biden any damage? You know, when people are watching it every night on TV and horrible things happening at the airport and people clinging to the wheels of planes taking off, you know, people have a reaction to that. But in the slightly longer term, well, you tell me, you know, maybe they'll feel glad we're out of that one, you know. You know, that's not a place that we want to be sending our guys. You know, the arguments that Biden was putting forward in his speech the other night.
Does the situation in Afghanistan have any significance for other countries? And I'm asking this because I see a lot of social media posting about, the Taliban were at the Russian embassy in Afghanistan and all this other stuff. And I don't really understand what significance this may have to other countries, not just in the region, but just in general.
I think it has an overall influence, you know, just like the Russian, you mentioned Russia just now, the Russian sort of failure to get what they wanted in Afghanistan, you know, is a blow to their prestige. They actually not, you know, not being in Afghanistan, you know, this is a sort of place in the mountains, you know, that they, it shouldn't have mattered so much to them, but it was a sort of symbolic defeat. And I think the same is true of the U.S., you know, that it, I think that's the main loss. How far does it, you know, these other countries, they'll be nervous about what happened. You know, the Iranians will be worried, particularly about the Shia. We spoke about them since Iran sort of feels that it must look after the Shia, its fellow Shia Muslims everywhere. You know, there'll be nervousness in Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, even Pakistan, which sees this as a victory, or most of Pakistan sees it as a victory. There'll also be nervousness. Will this sort of revivify the Pakistan Taliban, which was, you know, very violent and destabilizing the country a few years ago? Will it come back? China, but, you know, a bit worried about instability there. Would it have an effect on, you know, the Uyghurs in China? I think they'll all be waiting. They don't know the answers to these. But these aren't mortal threats facing them, but they are things that they worry about.
So I wanted to come back to something before we close out. You mentioned the diversity within Afghanistan. Are there any particular experiences you've had when visiting Afghanistan that maybe would give my listeners an insight into that country and the culture, or anything, personal experience, anecdotes, or just an insight you can give into maybe what Americans or people here in Western countries don't understand about Afghanistan?
Well, in 2001, as I mentioned, after 9/11, it became obvious that the U.S. was going to back the overthrow of the Taliban in Afghanistan. I was Moscow correspondent for The Independent. I went down to Tajikistan, just north of Afghanistan, to try and get across the border. I couldn't get, at that time, I couldn't get a visa from the Taliban to go, you know, officially to Kabul. And eventually, I sort of, this was anti-Taliban controlled territory in the northeast, and I got a helicopter to the Panjshir Valley, which is north of Kabul. Not that far north, but it's a very sort of well-defended area. And then one thing that struck me, and really it's a kind of a reverse which just happened now, is that, you know, the U.S. started bombing and missiles exploding, and you could see all the fireworks, you know, on the horizon. But when I sort of moved there, you went to the trenches, you found there weren't sort of dead bodies or even much wrecked machinery because the Taliban had already sort of retreated. They didn't fight for Kabul, you know, just like the present Afghan government. And then I followed them down towards Kandahar, and at one point I actually went through the remains of their front line, which made me extremely nervous. And they were going home. It was sort of they'd all decided, you know, that's it. Their leaders had done a deal. You know, they were going back to their villages, or they were going back to Pakistan. I got to Kandahar. I went out to some villages and met sort of former Taliban commanders who were very sort of confident. They said, people left them alone. They wouldn't do anything. But if the government pursued them, they'd fight. You know. Now, it's a bit the same situation in reverse now, in which it's been the government which has been dissolving and the Taliban that's been advancing without a fight. Now, it depends, I think, a lot. If they pursue the government forces, in other words, soldiers and, you know, all this stuff about interpreters and so forth, but actually anybody, you were in the, let's say you were in the Afghan army or something like that, and the Taliban pursues you, and if they resistance will start to them. If they're smart, they won't do this. But I'm not sure. You know, some guys at the top may be smart, but this is a pretty crude organization. You know.
Well, they've been at war for 20 years, so there's probably a lot of anger, and you know, we want revenge.
Sure, yeah, there are a lot of guys who think, you know, well, my brother was killed, my uncle was killed, and he was killed by, you know, this guy who was tortured to death by that intelligence officer in that town. Now I'm going to go looking for that guy, you know. Civil wars, you know, produce, particularly one as violent as this, produce a desire for vengeance, and also, you know, Afghanistan's a vendetta society. So certainly there'll be a lot of that. And people in, you know, Kabul today, I was just talking to somebody from there. You know, it's sort of the bread shops are open, the vegetable shops are open, but otherwise people are pretty frightened. And these are groups of Taliban wandering around, sort of knocking on doors, asking, you know, who is there, you know. And, they're not sort of doing much, but people are nervous that give them time, once international attention is focused elsewhere, they will start dragging people out of their houses. That, you know, that makes them very frightened. So I don't think, I doubt if the Taliban have the sophistication to play it cool, to let the sort of areas that are anti-Taliban enjoy a fair degree of autonomy, you know, to not be too repressive against women and in sort of secular areas in like Kabul. Population of Kabul is about 5 million people. This is pretty sort of secular. You know, if they did all that, don't put too much pressure, then things might stabilize under their rule. But it'll be some weeks or probably months before we know if they're going to do that. Personally, I have my doubts, you know.
Why do you have those doubts? I mean, is it just that it's a crude organization? Is there anything in particular?
Well, you've got this, you know, you've got this very sort of, you know, guys who want to go back to Sharia law, you know, guys who believe in, you know, you enforce law and order by chopping off hands and heads, guys who just been fighting a war in which they regard the other side as traitors to Afghanistan and traitors to Islam. You know, they're not; these aren't merciful guys, and they're not in a merciful mood. So that's why I think, or you know, it might be in their long-term interest, as I said, to stabilize things, not to push their victory too fast. Which is exactly what 20 years ago, that's exactly what the U.S.-backed forces did. They thought, "Aha, we've won a total victory. Everybody's going to do what we say now." You know, and the U.S. had basically
brought back the old warlords, who were exactly the sort of people who created the reaction led by the Taliban. And the U.S. behaved as, and its allies behaved as though the Taliban was gone forever. Now, if the Taliban does this in reverse, they'll be facing similar resistance. So, you know, it's sometime while we see this, you know, probably the ISA, Pakistan Intelligence, will try and restrain them. But, you know, you've got guys kind of been in the villages, they've been bombed, you know, they've seen a lot of their guys killed. Are they really just going to sort of have a light-touch government of Kabul and elsewhere? I really doubt it.
Last thing I want to touch on, and I want to thank you for going a few minutes over here, but, you know, I remember years ago, Time magazine had a cover saying the end of the Taliban. And, you know, I'm just curious, why do you think the U.S. got it so wrong? Because I look at what has transpired. I think we put a lot of people in power in Afghanistan that were very corrupt. And I think it created a reaction where the Taliban could come back. And also, it seems like this war, and I don't know if you'd agree with this, I mean, it seems like the Taliban was able to successfully flee and wait it out. So why did we get it so wrong? You know, we said, oh, it's the death of the Taliban, but now they're back.
I think people exaggerated in the Washington, exaggerated the extent of their victory. You know, I remember I was in Washington, you know, just for a few months at a think tank just before this happened, before just after the Afghan invasion and before the invasion of Iraq. And people were, you know, the sort of foreign policy guys were, you know, pretty triumphant, saying, you know, people said Afghanistan's been really difficult. In fact, it was a real walkover and so forth. And now we're going to do the same in Iraq. They didn't, I would say to people, well, you actually haven't sort of really defeated the other side, but they didn't believe that, you know, that they were overconfident. There's another thing you just touched on, which is, you know, the Taliban were backed by Pakistan strongly. They were backed before 2001. You know, Pakistan, I think, said, you know, come home, don't fight now, wait for the U.S. attention to go elsewhere, which is what happened in 2006. So they could sort of retreat into Pakistan. That was a very sort of major card for them, made it very difficult to defeat them. And the U.S. never really wanted to confront Pakistan. I mean, for a number of reasons, that this was, you know, a powerful state, nuclear power state, large army, big U.S. ally. And they never, if they were really going to get somewhere in Afghanistan, they needed to confront Pakistan. I'm not saying they should have done, but just in terms of sort of realpolitik, they should have done that. Of course, there were difficulties because all their supply lines went through Pakistan. But, you know, so there was a whole list of problems. But unless they faced up to that, they were going to be in real trouble, as they were. So I think they never really sort of thought it through, and always felt a few, you know, the generals felt another 10,000 troops, we can do it, and so forth. And you know, they felt the same in Iraq, and some still do. But I think that they didn't. They didn't, you know, they exaggerated their own strength. They didn't, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan are very difficult places to conquer because the central government tends to be weak, but these are fragmented societies, and those fragments are often pretty powerful. They're based on, you know, communities who defend their own interests. Now, the U.S. was facing that. Now, to some degree, the Taliban will face the same problem, and they, again, will have to decide between repression, extreme use of violence to assert their power, or a degree of conciliation. We don't quite know where they're going to come down yet. You see these sort of guys talking good English and saying moderate things at press conferences in Kabul, but I think that that's I don't think that's representative. I don't think that that's going to I don't think that they've changed that amount.
I guess a closing note here, just for my listeners, I've always been very interested in Afghanistan, the culture. I think it's a very beautiful country in a lot of ways. Do you think, I mean, there's been so much conflict there for so long, even before 2001. I mean, we can go back to the 70s. Is there any silver lining for Afghanistan in the future, in your view, or do we just not really know at this point where things are going to head?
I don't think we really know. I mean, like you, I like Afghanistan and I like Afghans. Partly I like their sort of diversity, you know, everything, you know, each community is different and, you know, of course, that also means it's a sort of disunited place. It used to be, you know, I used to like Beirut for the same reason, you know, that all the different communities. But of course, you know,
You cut out there for a second there. What were you saying was bad news for the future?
Well, when you have a very diverse society, you know, with different communities, with different interests, it makes it a pretty interesting place. You know, it's one of the reasons I like Afghanistan. I like Lebanon and Syria and Iraq. But it also means that, you know, you have unstable societies with in which the difference of parts of society are always colliding with each other. It makes them very difficult to conquer because, you know, you might conquer one part of that society but not the other, which is, as the U.S. discovered. And, you know, the same thing may now happen to the Taliban.
Well, I want to end on that note. Thank you so much, Patrick Coburn, for coming back on Parallax News. Listeners, if they want to read your work, I assume they can just go to The Independent. They can purchase your books, the latest one being War in the Age of Trump. Anything else I'm leaving out there? Or?
Well, yeah, I'm actually, they just Google my name on The Independent. They'll find the articles by me and the London Review of Books as well, where that's behind a paywall. And this whole, if they look at Amazon, they'll find a range of books, mostly about the Middle East. The latest one being, as you said, about War in the Age of Trump. Before that, the Age of Jihad. It's really a sort of history of the wars in the Middle East. The latest one about the war under Trump, and before that, the war stretching back, you know, to the 1970s. But thank you very much. Anyway.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. We will keep you posted with further reflections on Afghanistan to come. I hope you were able to learn something from the conversation with Patrick Coburn. As always, please, if you can, support my work at patreon.com/parallaxviews. $1, $5, $10, and $15 tiers. $10 and $15 tiers get the producer's credit shoutouts, which means shoutouts to Ed Spartacus, Gunner, Jamie, James, Catherine, Ork, Holland, Nathan, Mark, Martin, Gratz, Chase, Emilia, The War Nerd, Brian, and Mickey. My sincerest apologies if I sound tired. I've been working, burning the midnight oil at a breakneck pace, and I can only do it with the help of you, the listener. So if you care about the work I'm doing, please, please, please consider supporting me at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Even a dollar will help. I really appreciate the $5, $10, and $15 donations monthly, though. If you can, any of those tiers, please, please, please consider donating if you enjoy this program and find it enlightening. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. With Parallax Views. With Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight. With no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.